And before we begin, I should make introductions. On my left is Judge Rico Bishop from Lincoln, and on my right, Judge Michael Pirtle from Omaha, and I am Frankie Moore from North Platte. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Judge.
You may begin when you are ready.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming out here. It is very nice to have you here rather than having to travel. My name is Michael Noziska. I'm representing the appellant, Stephan Schutzle, in this matter. I believe that a lot of my arguments have been put forth as best as I can in my brief. However, I'd like to point out a couple of things that I want to pay particular attention to and maybe taken my assignments of error out of order. With regard to the second assignment of error, I allege that the court erred in allowing evidence to corroborate the allegations of sexual assault at trial. And what that really refers to is in exhibit number two, which was offered and received offered by the state and received by the court, references some other wrongful acts that Mr. Schutzle allegedly did. They weren't charged. Those weren't even really talked about in the trial, other than the fact that Exhibit 2 was published to the jury. And that is something that happens quite frequently, but the manner in which that was done is what we really have an issue with, how that happened. Exhibit 2, they went through, laid their foundation, it was received, but the problem with that is that those couple lines dealing with other wrongful acts. And the way I understand it, the State versus Valverde case gives a three-pronged test regarding the admissibility of that evidence. First one is the probability of that act occurring. The second, proximity in time and intervening circumstances of other offenses, and the similarity of the other acts of the crime charged. Didn't necessarily get, that wasn't necessarily addressed. But the other thing that it requires is that a hearing is held outside the presence of the jury as to the admissibility of that evidence. That was not done. As is pointed out in my brief, I was not the attorney for the trial. I got appointed, the family apparently had retained a private attorney after the jury's verdict was rendered. That attorney, which excused the trial counsel, that attorney apparently had a conflict, and I was appointed. So the only thing I have to go with, no firsthand knowledge, is reviewing the record. Very similar to what you're doing.
So aren't we limited? You've raised a good argument with regard to 414 and 404 on appeal, but there was no objection made, was there, at trial in that regard?
That's true. Which also leads perhaps to ineffective assistance of counsel argument. However, it wasn't raised, but when it was raised, and I believe as part of a motion for a mistrial, there's nothing in the record that indicates that the judge did a hearing outside the presence of the jury to determine whether that particular portion of that exhibit was admissible. Obviously, in the state's brief, they take a different approach at that. They say it is harmless error. I'm not sure that anybody reading that can just disregard that. At the trial, Mr. Florham made the motion for a mistrial. That was promptly denied. The judge indicated that he could ask for a limiting instruction if he chose to do so. That kind of puts him in a quandary then of having it addressed immediately or at the end and perhaps reinforcing the judge's position on that.
Sounds sort of like trial strategy.
Well, perhaps.
That we may not be able to reach on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim today. Would you agree with that?
And that's quite possible. It does pose a question. It's something that I, as now attorney, having to bring this forth on appeal, felt that it had to be addressed and had to be dealt with. Whether you choose to address it or however you address it, that's certainly within your discretion, and we have to either accept that or ask for further review if that becomes necessary. As I mentioned, reviewing the record, there is absolutely nothing that there was any sort of a hearing outside the presence of the jury. It may have happened. I don't know that. It's certainly not on the record.
And that hearing's required if the state desires to adduce evidence of other wrongful acts. Is that my understanding?
I believe that's correct, yes.
And so there's no indication, at least from our record, that the state was offering Exhibit 2 for the purpose of showing other wrongful acts.
I would argue that that might also be trial strategy on the state's part in order to perhaps plant that little seed, that little kernel that can grow and fester the entire jury trial and kind of sit in the back of their minds as they're deliberating when the time comes. I don't know how they would be able to just sit back and say, no, that didn't mean anything. It's just one of those things where I believe that it certainly had a great potential of poisoning the well, so to speak, sitting in their mind and potentially causing them to think a different way rather than maybe what the actual evidence without that would have provided. And as I mentioned, yes, that it was done over no objection by counsel. And I don't know, I just feel that that may have been an error on even counsel's part, which was addressed in the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. I think that the court should have had a hearing outside the presence of the jury, and then if admissible, then it could have been published to the jury. Perhaps it would have been redacted, at least that portion, so then we wouldn't have had that problem. That didn't happen that anyone's aware of, and so potentially Mr. Schutzle is sitting in the Department of Corrections, perhaps suffering from the result of that. A couple other things that I think are important is also with regard to the ineffective assistance of counsel. One of the things that I believe is important is the remoteness in time of the victim making her claim. It kind of makes me wonder why. Why now?
Wasn't that a question for the jury?
Well, it is. They certainly can weigh that accordingly, but it certainly makes it much more difficult for a criminal defendant to defend against a allegation that's made so far after it's happened. It reminds me very much of Bill Cosby's predicament. It's just a allegations are made, and then here we are. I'm not sure what she may have had to gain as opposed to what maybe he had to lose.
But he admitted to.
And that was a question that the jury had to maybe answer, was whether that was a false confession or not. He testified that he felt threatened by Officer Dowling sitting there with his firearm strapped to his hip. He had to go through the officer in order to leave that room.
But the jury was shown that entire interview.
It was, and I understand that. And that's a big hurdle to overcome. Certainly acknowledge that. And it appears that I'm out of time. If you have any other questions for me.
No further questions. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Austin Relf. I represent the state of Nebraska. This case presents numerous issues, the majority of which deal with, in some form or fashion, Mr. Schutzle's confession to law enforcement, videotaped confession. My plan today was to focus on the issues raised by Schutzle in his argument this afternoon, and to, of course, answer any questions that this court may have regarding the other issues in the case. Generally speaking, as set forth in our brief, our position is that his arguments have no merit, that there was no reversible error, and that this court should therefore affirm his conviction and sentence. Schutzle started off with Exhibit 2 and its admissibility at trial, so I'll do the same. As I said in my brief, that exhibit was objected to only on the grounds raised in the motion to suppress, as well as foundational grounds. Nothing was said about 404, 414, 403, anything raised in the brief. It wasn't until after the exhibit was shown over the course of 2 days, after cross, after the state rested, that it was raised in the motion for new trial. In our view, he's waived any argument that it was inadmissible at trial on those grounds.
Well, what about the argument that it was the state's responsibility to have a 404 hearing prior to trial?
I think even if it's the state's burden to tell the court that, it still falls on the defendant to object if that procedure isn't taken. And a failure to object, it's been said over and over, is a waiver of that issue on appeal. I wouldn't say it was intentional or anything by any means. From what I saw at the record, it seemed to be maybe everybody just missed it. I don't know. But the burden, I think, is still on the defendant to object to evidence that he deems inadmissible, and he didn't do that.
So how does that then lead to his second argument that is ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, and I tried to preempt that in my brief, because in our view, it's harmless error. And if it's harmless error, it cannot be prejudiced under the ineffective assistance framework. The reason for it being harmless error is, one, it's about 5 minutes worth of the video in about 3 hours. And it basically consists of the officer saying, well, what about anything else happened in, I think it was the fall of 2006, and he says, no, I don't remember anything. He pushes him a little bit, but I think my recollection is correct. He holds to his story that he doesn't remember anything. So it's relatively benign. It doesn't ever get addressed, in my recollection of the record, by any other witness, by the prosecutor, by defense in closing or opening statement. It's not an issue. And as my opposing counsel said, it wasn't really talked about at trial. And then finally, I think you have overwhelming evidence of guilt, most notably the confession. He admits this happened in that three-hour video. And then you have the victim's testimony, which was, strong, for lack of a better word. It was strong testimony, minor inconsistencies on cross. So to me, the relative insignificance of the second allegation combined with the overwhelming evidence of guilt renders it harmless error, and therefore, if you're looking at it through the ineffective assistance framework, you can dismiss it on direct appeal. As far as the motion for mistrial, again, that was based on the Exhibit 2 being admitted with the reference to that second allegation. It was presented to the district court. The district court said, I'm going to deny your motion. I will give you a limiting instruction if you'd like one. And counsel says, well, you know, I'll consider that offer, but I don't want to bring it to the jury's attention. So I don't see any error on the district court's part in denying a motion for mistrial. Again, considering that we, you know, our position is it was harmless error to begin with, no need for a new trial, and the court acted properly. The limiting instruction, again, it was offered to counsel. Counsel didn't do it. And, you know, it's hard to see any error on the part of the court there as well. And finally, with the ineffective assistance as far as the remoteness and time, counsel at trial emphasized that many times, opening, closing, on cross-examination of Kiana as well. So, you know, I'm not sure how much more counsel could have done in that regard at trial. And to us, it was simply, as Your Honor pointed out, a question for the jury, the credibility of the victim on that point, the reasons why she said she waited, which was essentially, you know, he had told her that, you know, nobody's going to believe you. She was scared. She said that it kind of resurfaced when her own sister went through suicidal tendencies, and that's what prompted her to tell her parents what had happened several years ago. So I think that addresses everything that Schutze brought up today, and I stand on what I said in my brief on the rest of the issues. Unless this court has any other questions, I'll submit it.
We have no other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe Mr. Nozick was out of time. Thank you, counsel. You are excused, and your case is submitted.